You're listening to DraftKings Network.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Now's a good time to remember where the story of tequila started. In 1795, the first tequila distillery was opened by the Cuervo family. And 229 years later, Cuervo is still going strong. Family-owned from the start, same family, same land. Now's a good time to enjoy Cuervo, the tequila that invented tequila. Go to Cuervo.com to shop tequila or visit a store near you. Cuervo, now's a good time.
Trademarks owned by Becle, SAB, the CV. Copyright 2024, Proximo. Jersey City, New Jersey. Please drink responsibly.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to the Big Suey, presented by DraftKings.
Why are you listening to this show?
The podcast that seems very similar to the other Dan Le Batard podcast.
I'm sorry, I'm not going to apologize for that.
In fact, the only difference seems to be this imaging.
I have been tempted in restaurants just walking past tables to grab somebody's fries that if they're just there. That hasn't happened to you guys?
I've done it.
And now, here's the marching man to nowhere, Fat Face, and the habitual liar.
You know what was the least popular thing I did in terms of scheduling sitters and spinning all these plates? Moving my daughter's birthday off of the 23rd because the Cessna cyclone season opens up on Friday.
Why? You moved your daughter's birthday?
Like yeah.
You changed it permanently.
It's her birthday, though.
Yeah, I like the idea of you changing her birthday permanently.
Okay, sorry. 923 is clone set.
FSU Miami always falls on that day. Sorry, you're going to have to get a new birthday.
Yeah. FSU Miami for a very long time always fell on my birthday weekend, and it was always during a stretch when FSU was dominating Miami, and it made for miserable birthday weekend.
I got to be honest. That is what I imagine, and I don't know whether he has kids or not, but Jeff DeForest doing with his 2 or 3 year old. You cannot change a child's birthday around the cyclones, around High Line, around college football. You cannot do these things.
Whoa, Dan, you know how starved this market is for a champion, and this show delivered a champion in the Cesta Cyclones. Inaugural battle. Well, was it inaugural? Who cares? It's the only one that anyone remembers. The Cesta Cyclones are running it back outside of one guy that Chris Cody said he was going to draft and then lied directly to his face. We're running it back. And we're national.
I didn't lie. I didn't know we weren't going to draft him.
We are making our ESPN 3 debut. That's right. You can follow our Cessna Cyclones that have a championship patch and way more Dan Le Batard Show with Stu Gatz branding. Now, to take advantage of the fact that we're on ESPN, we begin our title reign, our defense on Friday. And then on the 30th, the clones are going to be out there in full force with our NIL athletes.
Wow.
Watching our clones from the owner's box.
Yes.
Destiny Harden and Tyler Van Dyke are going to be out there waving their clones pom-poms.
It's just a little platform.
That's okay. Don't undersell it. It will be, we didn't know we were going to be on ESPN the last time, our infiltration. All of a sudden, we're watching Cyclone games on one of the ESPNs. Mike Ryan's giving out a trophy. No one told me we were doing any of this. Now we go into the next season as defending champions. But
and you'll be happy to know the last Battle Court season, the main marquee games were on Sundays. Obviously, it's football season. Your Saturdays and your Sundays are occupied. Nice little
Friday.
Spot for the Friday night lights. Yeah. Friday night Battle Court.
Who's your biggest threat this year? Who got better in the offseason?
Please don't ask any more questions.
What do you mean?
Warriors.
It's important.
It's
champions.
The Wall Warriors.
That is the best rivalry in all of Battle Court. It's the final last season when I was in an owner's suite that it was overtaken by Wall Warriors, and we somehow pulled one through. Wall Warriors, Cessna Cyclones, as fierce as a rivalry rivalry
you're,
gets
you're
in
trying
sports.
To actively alienate sentence. Our listeners.
No, it's a big
you?
One this Friday. Stu Gatz will be out Warriors. There. It's going to be great.
Where? That's why I prefer Darby.
Stu Gatz will not
wow,
be
Stu
out
Gatz
there.
Is going to be there.
No, who plays Gatz? Friday night?
Yeah, Stu Gatz is going to be out there. He has pledged his support of the Cessna Cyclones. He's going to be out there two consecutive Fridays.
Wow.
Here on the 23rd.
There's just no way that happens.
And on the 30th to celebrate our NIL deals.
I bet large amounts of money against Stu Gatz going.
The safe bet.
No, he promised.
Well, in that case.
What's a bigger favorite? Stu Gatz not showing up or Witty wearing a suit today on picture day?
He loves a picture day.
Put it on the poll, Guillermo, at Lebatard Show. Do you hate the guy who wears a suit on picture day? You mentioned Friday night. Also put on the poll at Lebatard Show. Who do you feel worse for on social media? The guy who gets caught liking porn without knowing he's getting caught liking porn? Or the person watching that person at 11 p.m. and showing to everyone else on the internet that that person was liking porn? What's the more pathetic act at 11 p.m. on a Friday?
I'd say Doc Rivers.
Chris Cody, you said that you had proof that you were feeling like a winner. You informed your father in the kitchen moments ago of the Franco Harris story from yesterday, that you thought the legendary running back, Hall of Fame running back for the Pittsburgh Steelers, who was the punctuation on the Immaculate Reception, that his name was Frank O'Harris, and that he was a white Great. Irishman who played...
Well, I didn't say all that. I just thought his name was Frank O'Harris. I didn't really know what he looked like. I just kind of heard the name. But you guys mocked me, I would say. Everyone in here. No one came to my defense saying, oh, I might have thought that too.
Why would we?
That's fair. But I'm telling you, the internet came to my defense, and Andrew Streeter found something on these streets that proves that I might be right.
Third down and nine. Bradshaw.
Franco Harris. Franco Harris. Pride and joy of the Emerald Isle. Franco Harris. Franco Harris. Give him half a yard. Take a mile, and if Terry Bradshaw knows what's up, he'll audible once again. 'Cause you hand it off to O'Harris, and he scores it every time.
Bradshaw trying to get away, and his pass.
Instead, he will embarrass your D-line. 'Cause you hand it off to O'Harris, and he scores it every time.
Hey! I'm sorry, Chris.
I mean,
that was great.
He should be Irish.
I'm telling you, I saw a lot of people on Twitter, a lot of smart people with blue check marks, learned yesterday that it was not Frank O'Harris.
Did you guys enjoy? I thought I could have watched for about 10 hours Eli Manning in makeup pretending to be awkward recruit Chad Powers walking on at Penn State. I could have watched 10 hours of that. Of his makeup looked so ridiculous. It looked nothing like Eli Manning, but that must have been so much fun for Eli Manning to go out to Penn State and just wow a bunch of coaches in makeup who didn't know it was Eli Manning. Mike, why are you shaking your head?
They all knew it was Eli Manning. Come on.
That was the worst one of, like, you see these type of things on the air. Oh, this famous person's going to, they usually are pretty decent. That one was clear. Everyone was acting. Dude, they were like, who's this guy walking up? He doesn't look like a freshman. It's like, come on.
Well, the coaches knew, but not the players.
I don't know. I wasn't buying that one.
You weren't.
He looks 42.
He really does. I'm looking at it now. He looks like Spagoli.
He didn't look like a college kid. He looked like he had a bit of a pituitary problem.
He looks like he could still play, if you ask me. He could sling it.
What surprises you, when he's with college kids, you realize, holy shit, Eli Manning was physically big.
And the name. Chad Powers. Good name. Like, come on. Like,
I'd sign that name.
Same.
Tony, are you ready to give us your top five football observations? That was a very, very sporty local hour. I do fear our audience is going to get so sick of the Tua talk if this is what it is after two games.
I was getting annoyed with it. Like, it's like, it's just like, we can't agree. Let's just like, we'll check back later in the season. Can we agree not to talk about Tua for 5 weeks?
Chris, I'm with you.
We can talk about the games. We can talk about the games, but let's not do the thing back and forth of, oh, he's got to, like, let's just wait for 5 weeks.
So
now.
You don't want to talk about Tua after the Bills
after
game.
After week seven.
Right.
That's when, Chris, we can have the next Tua conversation.
Your father, I have not seen your father that excited about sports. He came in here winded, and he said, this is what he explained to me. He said, Dan, I was talking so fast I didn't even recognize myself. It's like when I listen back to the Greg Cody show featuring Greg Cody with at 1.5 speed.
1.8. Yeah.
1.8 was ideal, you said last week.
It was
but
ideal.
Now with this new pep in your step, slow it down a little.
Pep in it. My dad always will tell me after recording, hey, can you just put this out at 1.8? Because I love the way I sound. I'm like, Dad, just bring more energy.
I can't do it naturally. I'm naturally lugubrious. I need that jolt of artificial vigor.
Well, Tua gave you the real vigor. You came in here and your speech was winded from the enthusiasm of wanting to talk about what happened on Sunday.
I haven't seen that since Marino was pitching to Duper and Clayton in 1986. It was unbelievable. It was a time warp. It was crazy.
Tony, we didn't have room. There were a bunch of people bouncing off each other to give their football opinions yesterday, so there wasn't even room for Tony's top five football observations.
And you'll be happy to know, now we finally have ample time to prepare for this segment. We got the imaging.
Yeah.
All right.
Tony's segment here.
Before you get to the imaging, just real quick, this will be a funny joke only to the handful of people who remember Sanford and Son. But I read from the Twitter account Super 70 Sports that Tom Brady is presently older than the first four seasons of Grady, the best friend of Red Fox Sanford and Son. Trust me when I tell you, it's funny to only people of a certain age, but Grady was old on television at the moment he was on television, and to think of Tom Brady as older than Grady's first four seasons of Sanford and Son seems impossible.
I thought you said meant Grady Sizemore.
Let's do top five.
He had a great beard.
Loved Grady.
He was very old. Let's do, Roy appreciated that. No one else in the shipping container has any Sanford and Son knowledge.
It's like anytime I hear the word camel meal, I'm like, whatever you mean. I don't know what that is.
Time now for Tony's top five observations.
That's not part of the image.
I thought that was in as a joke.
What up, Tony?
All right, guys. This is exciting.
Yes.
We got the music finally down.
Yeah.
We got the top five going. Let's start with number five.
I legitimately thought that the imaging was just going to be that sound.
A series of PC error noises.
Just one at the beginning and let Tony flounder out there by himself with the sound of his voice.
The beginning was going to be Clippy asking you what you want to do on Microsoft.
RIP, by the way, Clippy.
Number five. There's something about Cooper Rush.
No.
There's something about him.
Come on.
Michael Zayer, he saw it in person.
Yeah.
There's something about him.
Yeah.
They're going to talk themselves into he's better than Dak Prescott, aren't they?
Maybe. Depends on if that defensive line plays the same way. Number four. We need a Marcus Lattimore versus Mike Evans MMA match at the end of the season. We just need it. They fought twice already in the last like 3 years. We just need them. Bare knuckle in the middle of the. We do it at Jerry War. We could sell tickets.
Who do you got?
Right in the middle.
Who do you got?
Mike Evans.
Yeah. I would like Mike Evans to have to serve that suspension in order to just dilute it a bit only the next time he has to face Lattimore, because I think he'd prefer it that way anyway.
He actually would, yeah.
He doesn't want to go up against that guy.
His splits are really bad. Number three. This is going to be exciting for everybody in here. Tua has some juice.
Yeah. Wow, juice.
A little note. Game manager to game changer? Question mark?
Whoa, hello.
What are you, writing graphics for First Take?
Question mark? I mean, he's been a game manager so far, and all of a sudden, is he evolving into a game changer?
So much for waiting until week seven. I like that.
Number two.
Nathaniel can't hack it.
Guy stinks.
Yeah, like what you did there.
He is so bad.
It's writing.
Russell Wilson was 8 for 29 or something. I'm like, what is happening here? Anyways.
And number one?
Number one. The most impressive thing I saw. Tony's top five for week two. Kyler Murray doesn't need to read defenses as long as he can do that. He doesn't need to.
Right.
He doesn't need to. He ran for 25 seconds around, got into that two-point conversion, threw a ball to AJ Green. He was sliding down between 17 people. He's amazing. Doesn't need to read defenses. Forget it.
Thank you, Tony. there were so many things that we didn't talk about in the football weekend, Stugatz, because, and I don't know, Cody, do you have any interest outside of the Dolphins? Because when I'm watching last night, you guys tell me if you guys have read or heard a good explanation for how it is the Vikings could look like that and do that to Aaron Rodgers. And then you see the Vikings and Kirk Cousins is terrible in prime time again. And Justin Jefferson, who I don't believe can be covered by anybody, when they throw to Justin Jefferson, he gets one catch and Darius Slay gets two interceptions. You explain to me the difference between what the Vikings look like against the Packers and what the Vikings look like against the Eagles. You bet Vikings?
I took the Vikings, yes. Made the mistake. I didn't realize how bad Kirk Cousins has been in prime time, but I did take the Vikings. I can't really explain it other than football. Like, maybe the Vikings just better at home than they are on the road. He's that bad in prime time, but I can't really explain it.
Well, he was 5-17 in prime time before last year. He did win two in prime time. And Philadelphia was, I was shocked they were only favored by 2 points at home. I thought Philly was going to win one of the...
It's because of what Minnesota did to Green Bay. It's because of how they made Aaron Rodgers look.
Listen, this league, this season, I know it seems like we say this every year, maybe this year more so. I want to admit something, and I'm embarrassed to say it. After 2 weeks, my record of predicting games is 14-17-1. Not against the spread, overall. I am under 500 just picking games. It's ridiculous. Those big four comeback games, I had all three of them before the comebacks. I mean, it's crazy the NFL this year, more so than usual.
How does that stat work? The big four comebacks game you had?
I had all four
wins. He was right for
wins.
A half.
I had That's all four wins until the ridiculous comeback. I had the Ravens.
Okay, but let's not.
You had the Browns?
Let's acknowledge around here that it's hard, obviously, to pick correctly these games. Someone explain to me, Dalvin Cook, explain to me Derrick Henry combining for 42 yards last night. For the two of them, two running backs that I expect to not be 42 yards of offense.
But once that game got away from Tennessee, there's no more Derrick Henry.
Well, no, the Dalvin Cook one is easier to explain because of the shape that game took. There was a point in the game, in the Bills game, where it was still within reaching distance for the Titans. Remember, it was 7-7 after a quarter. Derrick Henry actually scored on the first drive. There was a point where I saw the stat line was 11 carries for 13 yards for Derrick Henry. Now, I know Taylor Lewan went down, and the second he went down, that game was over because Tennessee had a game plan going into that to run the ball, control it. They were actually doing all right in the line of scrimmage. He went out. It was game over. Derrick Henry does look different after that foot injury. Remember how explosive he would look on a toss. You would toss to Derrick Henry, and he would get a head of steam going, and he was impossible to bring down. He looked so slow coming out of the break compared to what he was.
How can it be so fragile, though, that we spend 7 years analyzing Ryan Tannehill? The league tells you, can't start. Can only have a backup job. You're going to have to come to Tennessee and you're going to have to sit behind Mariota. And then all I have to do behind Tannehill is give him the most overwhelming theme we've ever seen at running back. They're a one seed. They look like they'll maul physically anybody in the league. Vrabel makes the decision to play Derrick Henry in a playoff game, and it costs them the game because he's got a plate in his foot and he's not Derrick Henry anymore, and they're not the same team anymore. And look at what Tannehill looked like last night when he's got no Derrick Henry. When you're trying to artificially put around a guy who's not value at quarterback anymore because he's expensive, a bunch of pieces that hide, protect him, aid him, and it's all as fragile as Derrick Henry's foot in a game that's so violent that whatever assessments we're making now are going to be irrelevant 3 weeks from now, because all over the fields everywhere, the halftime reports are a reporter coming in and saying, this person's still in the locker room, this person's got a shoulder, this person's got a knee, this person's got an ankle, and everyone by the end of week seven is going to be crawling on their knees and torsos.
Except Brady.
Yeah, but the Titans were kind of built around Derrick Henry, and they were just hoping for Derrick Henry to be the outlier that he had been for the 4 years prior. I mean, everything that you hear about Derrick Henry is how much he ran under Nick Saban, that entering in the NFL, he had a lot of wear on those tires, and yet he might have put up a Hall of Fame career by age 28. And I'm not even saying he still can't be good. It's just that Derrick Henry that we saw exploding out of the break once getting a toss, that was the fastest guy on the field at 6'3" in his weight, is probably done.
How can the construct be so flimsy, though, that Vrabel goes from the one guy in the Belichick camp that can lead and outsmart Belichick on clock management to three games later, if you can't hand it to Henry, you're done as a team. And look, Tannehill's got two interceptions, and you're not going to win anything in that conference with those quarterbacks.
The window, man. The window closed on them, and they actually had a three-year window, I think, and that's... And for unless you have these dynastic teams and these quarterbacks that are top level, that's pretty much what it is. The Eagles, if you look back to the core that won that title, it's a huge outlier. They flashed for a very brief, small window. That window closed rapidly.
And Tannehill had his best receiver taken away from him. When you do that to Aaron Rodgers, he's still Aaron Rodgers. When you do that to Tannehill, he's not nearly as good.
Mike, you said that window, the window closed easily and quickly. It's reopened. It's closed and reopened.
Yeah, different but the core. Eagles, they revamped the entire roster.
Different
Dan.
Core, different coach.
But what I'm saying is in that speed, in the speed of you just saying the Eagles are done, I'm like, no, they're not. The Titans are.
No, I was holding up the Eagles Super Bowl champion of Nick Foles. Like, if you look at that team and that core, Fletcher Cox is the only player that was on that roster before, maybe Miles Sanders. But they totally revamped the roster, and so far so good, two games into it. I love their draft strategy. They got A.J. Brown. They did what the Dolphins did and get this quarterback as many possible weapons, and let's still leave ourselves flexible for next year if we realize that we're a quarterback away. Right now, the bet on Jalen Hurts to give him the talent to see what he can do is so far working.
To Mike's point on Derrick Henry, he had 219 carries through 8 games last year.
He was amazing. He was on pace for 2,000 yards last year. Foot injury happens. Maybe they rushed him back a little bit. We all saw
did. No, maybe.
Definitely, because he looked like a shell of himself in that playoff game. But now you're left wondering, is he forever changed after that foot injury?
Greg Cody, football expert, 14-17-1, picking games for I don't know how many years for the Miami Herald.
32.
Someone tell me somewhere, send it to the show where I can read something that explains to me how Jalen Hurts can look like that against the Vikings when Aaron Rodgers looked like he did against the Vikings. Because in week-to-week analysis of doing games and betting on games, I don't know anybody who would have predicted what I just said, which is Jalen Hurts will put up whatever it was, the 26-32, and I'm running all over the field and I've got the best offensive line in football.
Right.
And Aaron Rodgers would not be able to do anything against the Vikings.
The Packers had a ton of drops in that game.
And no receivers. He was thrown to his running back.
No, Lazard is really important. And yes. Lazard, it's been, I saw on social media, somebody highlighting Lazard's downfield blocking. Their identity is run first in Green Bay. They are a run first team. They need to get the running game cooking. If they fall back, you need to count on receivers to make plays downfield. Aaron Rodgers had the open throw. You had a drop. Game was over after that because then Minnesota takes the ball and scores, and you don't have any faith in your receivers. And over the last two week ones, Aaron Rodgers and the Packers kind of check out on week one if it's not going their way.
I'll take a stab at it as well, because last year the Green Bay Packers lost to New Orleans on the opening day 38-3, and there was a lot of conversation after week one about the teams that just didn't play any of their starters any snaps. And Green Bay has done that for 2 years in a row, have come out completely flat in week one. I mean, you look at the Minnesota difference, so much of what we saw in that game last night is that Justin Jefferson has no space, when in week one, he was in acres of space. He had 15 yards either side of him on a big touchdown. Green Bay just didn't seem ready for week one. And you talk about Aaron Rodgers trying to mesh with new receivers, 7 points, like that stuff takes timing, takes game reps. And it seems like Aaron Rodgers just needs one in order to start getting going.
If I was a fantasy owner of Aaron Jones, I would be really happy right now, because the blueprint to me is, look, Aaron, Lazard's real good. You're right. But other than that, he's got no elite wideouts, and Lazard's not elite, but he's good. You have to run the ball if you're Green Bay, and that's what we saw last night. Aaron Jones is super good. He's a top five back in the NFL, but when you have Aaron Rodgers, he's not always allowed to show it.
And they have Quadzilla, the quad father, and A.J. Dillon, too, who is still young, powerful, fast, can help out in the passing game. They have a very dynamic running attack. And when you don't have people to block downfield and you can't get that running game going and the game situation gets out of hand, you lose who you are.
How is Aaron Rodgers on a run-first team?
I want to ask you something, Stugatz. How are you not aware of Kirk Cousins in prime time? Because I feel like there are two things that we know about Kirk Cousins. We've been arguing about him for years, about whether or not he's good or not, worth the money, et cetera, et cetera.
So one of the things is we don't know.
And one of the things that we're always doubting about him is every time he plays in one of these important games, we all see him stink, except for the one playoff game on the road against New Orleans.
Right.
The one game against New Orleans where we're like, oh, he made the throw at the end, and he beat Drew Brees on the road, and we're like, maybe we can talk ourselves into it. But otherwise, there's no one else in the sport who has quite this reputation, Stugatz. If you put him as the sole game and he's not playing at 1 o'clock or 4 o'clock with a bunch of other games,
right,
you're going to lose that game and everyone's going to say Kirk Cousins stinks. That's a weird thing to have draped around your neck.
It's easy to gamble my money after the game, armed with the results. I mean, I took the Vikings. Listen, I was 4-1 over the weekend. I mean, give me a little credit. I know Greg's having a tough season. I'm having maybe my greatest season ever picking games, college and the NFL. So much so, I feel a super Twitter follower in my future.
Wow.
Because I'm giving away these picks for free, and really people should be paying for them. I mean,
how did you turn into?
I was 9-2 last week.
Knowing Kirk Cousins was any good in primetime, how'd you turn it into a referendum on your gambling record?
You picked at the scab. You wanted to highlight the one he got wrong.
I didn't know how many he got right or wrong. I want to understand this thing that Kirk Cousins
Let's talk
is,
about my winners,
is I mean. Draped in, because no one else in the sport is draped in that thing.
The thing about Cousins isn't just the primetime. It's also the fumbling. He's a notorious fumbler. He did it again last night, and they showed a stat on the screen. 72 fumbles since, I think, 2016.
Since he became a starter. Most in the NFL.
The most in the NFL by a lot.
Yes.
9-2 against the spread is all that Stugatz has to say about Kirk Cousins.
I mean, you're criticizing me for taking the Vikings.
If I was 9-2, I'd be saying it.
I thought it was a different Viking team, you know? Kevin O'Connell. By the way, Kevin O'Connell looks like a guy named Kevin O'Connell. I mean, he does.
I was throwing into your lap, can't perform in prime time. I thought it was the wheelhouse. You decided to show me your gambling bona fides the first 2 weeks.
The Dan Le Batard Show with Stugatz is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's time for a self-check-in. How's your social battery right now? Is it drained or bursting with energy? Similar to how a battery stores energy before eventually running out, individuals with a social battery may feel a need to recharge or withdraw from social situations after a certain amount of time. It can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin, especially with work or social gatherings. What's the right amount of socializing for you, and how do you recharge? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need some more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/DLB today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/DLB.
Hey, listening audience, it's Mike Ryan, and you're a sports fan if you're listening to this show. Well, up for debate. You may not know this, but Game Time is now an authorized ticket marketplace of Major League Baseball, which makes getting tickets even faster and easier. Prices on the Game Time app actually go down the closer it gets to first pitch, with killer last-minute deals, all-in prices, views from your seat, that's key, and their low-price guarantee. Game Time takes a guesswork out of buying MLB tickets. I was actually in Baltimore last season, always wanted to check out that ballpark, and I actually went to the Game Time app to actually see exactly what I was dealing with, and on top of that, I got a killer deal. Take the guesswork out of buying tickets with Game Time. Download the Game Time app, create an account, and use code DAN
for $20 off your first purchase. Terms apply. Again, create an account and redeem code DAN for $20 off. Download the Game Time app today. Last minute tickets, lowest price, guaranteed.
Don Levitard.
If all the raindrops were lemon drops and gumdrops, oh, what a rain that would be.
Stugatz.
Standing outside with my mouth open wide. Ah, 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 ah. If all the raindrops were lemon drops and gumdrops, oh, what a rain that would be.
This is the Don Levitard Show with the Stugatz.
We're presented by DraftKings Sportsbook, an official sports betting partner of the NFL. Download the DraftKings Sportsbook app today and use code DAN for a special offer when you sign up. That's code DAN, only at DraftKings Sportsbook.
Been wanting to talk to Anna Wolf for a couple of days. She writes for Mississippi Today, and she's done thorough, exhaustive reporting that not a lot of people are doing in local news these days as newspapers die a little more and corruption and accountability start failing all over the place. So you've got, Anna, this story with Brett Favre. And thank you for joining us. Thank you for the piece that you did, because it was thorough, and I know you must have had a whole lot of people playing defense against you, embarrassing a local icon. So thank you first for being on with us, and thank you for the work. What can you tell us about how the last few days have been for you? Because reporters like to report good stories, but don't like so much what can come with them sometimes. I don't know if you're getting universal applause or not.
Sometimes I think I have like selective hearing, because I don't really get, you know, hate mail, or people are not really mad about what I'm doing. It doesn't seem like. I think that there has been a lot more national attention on this story, and it's always interesting to see what is going to capture the national attention. Because I've been working on the story for 2.5 years, 3 years, 4 years, in terms of just reporting on what welfare is in Mississippi. I'm eager for people to learn about this story. So I'm glad, you know, whatever it takes, that people are hearing it.
It's particularly appalling, right? Mississippi's in the 50s in all the bad categories, and there's only 150 for lack of affluence, for poverty. And so when Brett Favre is evidently, your reporting suggests that he's stealing from the poor, obviously that's something that America is going to pay attention to. But can you take us through the last 4 years and what you're doing with your reporting?
Sure. So, I mean, going back to the beginning, I started at Mississippi Today in 2018. And I really, you know, went to the editor of the publication and said, we don't have someone reporting on poverty in Mississippi, and we need someone. So I pitched him the beat, and I got hired, and my first goal was to figure out what we were doing with this fund. You know, temporary assistance for needy families is the federal fund we're talking about. And I knew that I could look to that program as an indicator of how the state addresses poverty, because the funding is so lax and states really have such broad discretion on how to spend the funds, that I knew that I could look to that to see, you know, how does the state regard the poor? That would be the perfect place to start, since the state can do virtually whatever it wants with it. And really the goal at the beginning was just to find out how people are being served in Mississippi. You know, are the programs effective? Is what we're doing effective in drawing people out of poverty? You know, why is our poverty rate so high when we get, you know, 40% of our budget is from federal funds? Much of which is intended to help people out of poverty. And so that's how it started, pretty innocently enough. I remember at the beginning of my time at Mississippi Today, I kind of sat on the floor with these TANF federal reports splayed out on the floor, trying to make sense of the numbers. And eventually, just, you know, less than a couple years later, this huge scandal broke, and it was kind of the culmination of these efforts to find out what we were doing with this money.
But what is the answer to your question? Why is it that Mississippi can't distribute these funds ethically enough?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is a problem across the country where the welfare rolls, the people receiving cash welfare assistance, have dropped dramatically since the 90s, since the genesis of this program. And so, you know, the state's still getting the money every year, no matter if the people who are applying for it are being approved or not. And so that means that if the money's not going to people in poverty, then the state still has the money to spend on virtually whatever they wish. And the welfare program in Mississippi, it doesn't prioritize outcomes. It doesn't look to see if what we're doing with the money actually puts a dent in poverty. It really more can be used as a way to further this idea about people in poverty that, you know, people just need to get a job, or, you know, people in poverty aren't taking care of their kids well enough, or, you know, they're broken families. We need fatherhood programs to encourage fathers to take care of their kids. I mean, very like stereotypical and frankly racist and racially charged notions within our welfare program that, you know, say that people in poverty just need a pep talk from Brett Favre in order to escape poverty, and not actually prioritizing evidence-based practices for interrupting generational poverty.
Tell people what happened here with Brett Favre, the most appalling of the details. And where did this start for you? Because I feel like you've done, this was the latest story, but this is the second time that I've read about Brett Favre stealing from the poor. This one just seems to be more thorough or more advanced on the timeline than the first time that this came out.
Right. So we broke a story back in 2020, so over 2 years ago. Right after six people were arrested within this welfare scandal. And one of the charges within those indictments was that this nonprofit founder took $2 million from the welfare program and invested it personally in a pharmaceutical company called Prevacus that was developing a drug to treat concussions. And I don't know if you've seen this media, but Brett Favre was very much a spokesperson for this pharmaceutical company. He was going around telling people that, you know, they needed to invest in it because it was going to be this revolutionary drug that was going to, you know, help athletes, you know, prevent brain damage from concussions. And we were able to tie that to Brett Favre at the outset, and not just tie him to this pharmaceutical company, but then also realizing that this $5 million that went to build a volleyball stadium at University of Southern Mississippi was also a project that Favre was pushing. And that kind of just informed how our welfare program was operating, that someone like Brett Favre could come in and have so much influence over how the money was spent. So that was in 2020. And then all along the way, we've sort of learned, you know, it's been kind of a trickle of information out that we've learned more and more about how he communicated with these welfare officials to make this happen. Back in April, we published what I think are some of the most explosive pieces of communication, where Brett Favre was offering the governor stock in the company in exchange for his help, and you know, telling the governor that they were getting this money from the state. And 2 days after the governor, former Governor Phil Bryant, left office, he agreed by text message to accept the stock in the company. And, you know, that story didn't really reach the national airwaves. But fast forward to today, just last week, we published text messages that show that give a little bit more insight into his thinking around the volleyball stadium, where he was communicating with the nonprofit founder who had this money, about moving the money to the volleyball stadium. And he even said at one point, you know, if you give me this money, will the media find out how much and where it came from? And I think that kind of, you know, communication showing how they were operating in secrecy has been sort of what has captured the national attention so much. But at the end of the day, like, this has been a more than 2 year process in trying to determine how he was involved. And we've been there every step of the way.
How did you get those texts?
So these most recent text messages were gathered by the attorney for Nancy New, who's the nonprofit founder that was spending this money. But most of the other text messages that I described have been gathered by investigators. And so they are part of the investigative file that the FBI, you know, has possession of and is continuing to use to investigate this scandal.
Nancy knew she pled guilty, right, to 13 felonies within this welfare scandal?
That's right. That includes fraud and bribery and even a RICO charge, racketeering.
And she is doing this because there are people above her who know things, right? She doesn't, she's not at the top of this.
That's right. She, at the very beginning, the state auditor who investigated the scandal initially really put all the focus on Nancy New and the former director of the Department of Human Services, who was a Phil Bryant appointee, John Davis, and really kind of made the story about them, about the scheme that they were perpetuating. But, you know, more and more we've learned that they were really taking orders from the top. Certainly, Nancy New didn't necessarily have a relationship with Brett Favre that she was willing to put, you know, so much of her life on the line for him. There were other people involved. And I think she received a pretty generous plea deal back in April after our stories first published. That only suggests that she's got information that they find valuable on people higher up the chain. And she's working with prosecutors at this point. I feel like her position is that she's already pled guilty. She doesn't really have that much to lose. So at this point, I think she's willing to, you know, get the real story out there and just, you know, make sure that the public knows the truth, that she didn't act alone.
Anna, what was happening here? Is Brett Favre just close with the governor and he can just call in favors?
That's what it appears to be. There is a missing piece of the timeline here that has come out more recently. We know that Brett Favre met with welfare officials in July of 2017. And at that initial meeting, John Davis, the head of DHS, verbally committed $4 million to the project. You know, this is a state agency head. This is a bureaucrat. He's not going to do that without, some reason to do that or some approval to spend $4 million of state agency funds. He answers directly to the governor. So we don't know, you know, exactly how that meeting got set up, but I don't think it was Brett Favre's idea to target the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program. I don't know that Brett Favre knows or knew what TANF was. So someone had to make that connection for him.
Is Phil Bryant just a fan of the quarterback? Is the governor just fanboying?
That's a good question. I mean, I think going back to what I was describing earlier, this fund was such a target for abuse, such a target for manipulation they could have used the money on virtually anything. And so when you think, like, why would the state leaders of the state do this for Brett Favre? Like, I just don't think they thought that it was that big of a deal. You know, Brett Favre's kind of like Mississippi's favorite son, right? We in Mississippi, where we rank 50th in so many bad things. And one thing that we actually do pretty well is we produce some pretty good athletes and we exalt those athletes. We exalt celebrity in this state. And I think our state leaders in particular, Phil Bryant, they wanted to use their position to ingratiate themselves and feel close to people that made them feel important and powerful.
And I want to explain to the audience, perhaps they know this, but I don't think they do, the amount of work and effort that goes toward chasing these injustices down, the resources. How much defense was played against you to make sure that you couldn't get at the truth here? Because nobody wants you to, these people don't want to be exposed this way.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I mean, I can't even describe all of the roadblocks that I received that I was up against in trying to get this information from the Department of Human Services long before there was any indication of a scandal occurring, right? I just was very innocently wanting to know what we were doing with this money and how we were helping people. And frankly, they had no information about, you know, the people that they were serving. So there was no information about how Nancy New's organization was helping people out of poverty. There wasn't data on how many people got jobs or how much money people were making after exiting the program. There just wasn't really anything there to show for. And I was trying to get expenditure reports and I've been calling it gaslighting because they would send me things that didn't really make any sense. They weren't what I was asking for, but they would never get on the phone with me. I could never actually talk to another human. So I was just sending email after email, you know, please tell me how you're spending this money. I just want to know that it's helping people. And, you know, I can recall one public records request that I got that could have potentially, if it were actually responded to, we could have probably learned a good bit earlier on than we did, but they charged me, you know, several thousands of dollars, or wanted to charge me several thousands of dollars that I just couldn't pay for the records. And that's a pretty typical, you know, tactic, delay tactic, or obstruction tactic that state officials use to prevent public information from getting out.
How much were you lied to?
And I, you know, I was thinking about this text message that I sent Brett Favre in early 2020, you know, while I was breaking the stories about his involvement with the pharmaceutical company and also the volleyball stadium. I asked him very simply if he had ever had a conversation with the governor about the volleyball stadium, and he said no. And that's in a text message. I mean, that seems like a pretty simple thing, but that's a pretty big lie that we now know, only just found out, you know, really this week on paper, have proof that that was a lie. And it has been that constantly throughout this process.
I would imagine, given the story, the way that you're telling it, you're coming in with the best of intentions. Let me report on whether funds for the poor are getting to the poor and how. Let me just get at the truth of this. And you had no idea that Brett Favre's name would scroll across your desk. You didn't even have any interest in that, right?
That's absolutely right. You know, I never really thought that the stories that I told were going to be very sexy or very well read. I just was passionate about getting to the heart of the issue of poverty in Mississippi, because I had started out, you know, earlier at the Clarion Ledger, the statewide newspaper, reporting on healthcare. And that was a beat that I really cared about, but I kept coming across this scenario where I would be reporting on healthcare issues, healthcare billing. And the real problem was poverty at the core. You know, it was poverty kept being the overlapping factor that would, you know, it was really the sort of the root cause of so many of the things that I was writing about. And no one was just purely writing about poverty. And so that's what I was trying to tackle. And the simplest way to do that, in my mind, it seemed to be tackling public assistance programs. What is the Department of Human Services doing for people? And that's really how all of this began.
How else did Governor Phil Bryant obstruct you beyond that common tactic in Freedom of Information Act when they make you pay thousands of dollars for documents so that it becomes too expensive to find what the truth is?
I mean, that's the main one, but also, you know, they wouldn't talk to you. So you can't, not every single question can be answered with a record. I mean, we can get really close, and that's the best, you know, records are king as far as sources in my perspective, but you know, at the end of the day, like there's some things that you have to talk to a human about, and they would not let anyone talk to me. At one point, they started diverting all of my communication with the Department of Human Services through the AG's office. And so if I asked a simple question about, you know, what's happening with these applications for TANF or anything like that, I'd get a response from the Attorney General's office, who, you know, they couldn't answer my question. They didn't know, you know, what the answer to this social safety net program question was. Phil Bryant didn't grant Mississippi Today an interview in, I think it was like a 3-year period that, and this predates me at Mississippi Today, but that he would not grant a single interview to this publication, you know, until we got those text messages back in April regarding Prevacus and the stock agreement. He sat down with us for 3 hours, and basically his answer was that he didn't read his text messages carefully enough. So where we thought we had, you know, pretty good evidence to show how he was involved with this scheme, he was saying that, yeah, I sent those texts, but I didn't read them carefully enough to appreciate what I was responding to. So the listeners can, take what they will from that.
Yeah. And I'm curious, when the last couple of years are consumed by some of this stuff, because I imagine you're a bit of a freedom fighter. Even as you're being objective, you're trying just to do the right thing. I won't call it activism, mm-hmm. but you're seeking the truth. How often are you coming home and telling your friends or anybody, you're not going to believe what happened today? You're not going to believe how shitty these people are today.
Oh, yeah. I think my friends are completely sick of me and hearing about welfare in Mississippi. I mean, but, you know, you got to vent to somebody about, you know, the gaslighting, like I said, is really the big thing. you know, back in 2019, when I was really going in hard on the agency, Bill Bryant sent a text to the welfare director, John Davis, who, as you know, is facing all of these charges. And he sent a screenshot of a tweet that I made to the director. And he said, and it was a graph that I had created that illustrated how the state was spending welfare money. And he sent the graph to the director and he said, how is she figuring this? And then the director responded and said, she's advocating for more people to receive cash assistance, which is not what I was doing at all. And that's a really, you know, important point that, like, I have no opinions about how welfare money should be spent. All I cared about was seeing what the outcomes were. So if we don't want to spend welfare money on direct cash assistance to people in poverty, that's fine. I mean, what else are we doing with it that's helping them escape poverty? If we were using the money not on cash welfare at all, but on, you know, evidence-based practices, workforce development, things that helped people find self-sufficiency, and then they could show me the data where they were doing that, I'd be perfectly happy with that. But that's not what they were doing. And so he shoots back a text to the welfare director saying, and this is about 2 to 3 months before the welfare director is exposed for this scandal and ousted from office. He says, Phil Bryant says, she is a raving liberal. Keep up the good work.
Okay. It's just sort of government officials stealing money the way it's happening all over America. Can you just explain on your way out, and thank you again for the time and the reporting, can you explain to people what it is to steal $5 million from this fund? Can you explain it with the expertise of 2 years knowing how poor Mississippi is and how much these people could better use this money than on a volleyball stadium for Brett Favre's daughter?
Absolutely. So the number of people that we could have served with $5 million would have filled that volleyball stadium, every seat in that stadium, 8 times. We're talking about childcare. We're talking about workforce development. We're talking about electricity bills. We're talking about, you know, food assistance, diapers for small babies. These are the things that we could have been supporting with these funds that that we were not. And the money instead went to this volleyball stadium. But I want to make the point that, you know, while this purchase, this volleyball stadium might have been illegal, the money could have been spent perfectly legally and is all across the country. $16 billion a year is spent from this fund. And it could have been spent perfectly legally and still never helped anyone, because there is a systemic issue within our social safety net programs in this country, particularly this fund, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, that allows states to divert this money away from the people that need it and doesn't require states at all to use the money on evidence-based practices for interrupting generational poverty.
It's deeply depressing, Anna. Like, it really is. The way that you describe it is so systemically flawed as to be heartbreaking every day. I wonder if you feel like you're tilting at windmills sometimes because it's so appalling.
Absolutely. But, you know, a lot of the people that I talk to, and it is heartbreaking, but they're so resilient. You know, we've got great people in this state who are making it work despite everything that they have up against them. And I want to do this job justice for them.
It's noble work. I am sure it's going to be prize winning. Thank you very much for your efforts, because it really is. I don't think people understand how hard it is to do this kind of reporting locally, not just because of the obstacles with people, but because this kind of stuff needs resources. And it's hard to have a reporter working on one thing for 2 or 3 years that, you know, is about a group of people that not enough people care about.
Yeah, I'm incredibly fortunate to work for a publication that prioritizes this kind of work. And, you know, it's MississippiToday.org. Anyone can check it out. We are a nonprofit, and so we operate based on grants and donations.
Thank you, Anna. Excellent work.
Thank you so much.